We're moving now to the administrative items, item 18. So, Mr. Robertson, if you can introduce the topic.
Not only will I introduce it, I will probably do most of it, speak to most of it. Okay, this is the executive officer's report, item 18. I'll start off with tables 1 and 2. Table 1 is the water quality certification applications received between August 10th and October 19th of this year, totaling 8 applications. Table 2 reflects the water quality certifications issued during that same period, totaling 13 certifications issued. And I will move on to Buckley Road, unless there's questions. This is our next installment of the Buckley Road trichloroethylene cleanup project discussion. The key feature I would call your attention to was, Dr. Wolf actually referenced this as well because he attended, was the November 1st community meeting. And it was well attended. There were approximately 40 residents and stakeholders, and I want to acknowledge them for coming because this was the night of Game 7 of the World Series. Yeah, it was. Didn't go well.
That did not add any value.
You should have gone to the public meeting, is what you should have done. Clearly. In addition, the State Water Board Division of Drinking Water was in attendance, as was the San Luis Obispo County Environmental Health staff. And our staff, specifically Dean Thomas, Sarah Hinkle, I've got to get used to the new name, and Taya Tryon provided presentations, and then we did an extended question and answer session with the attendees. Any questions?
Yes. Pardon me. I think in your report, you note that individual residents have been notified about the well testing. And I can't spot it now in my notes, but I think it was noted that some people declined to have their wells tested or didn't respond. Am I finding it? Yes, thank you, I marked it. Last sentence in the well sampling on page 4. 13 wells were sampled as part of this effort, as staff did not receive responses from some well owners contact in the Buckley Road area. I was just curious, what kind of contact are we talking about? Did they get a knock on the door or just a letter?
Taya Tryon. The 13 samples that were collected was a resample. So we have sampled all the wells in that area. We wanted to take another look to see what has happened to the plume, to see if it's stable or moving. Mm-hmm. And so we reached out to well owners that we already had emails for and phone numbers that we'd been in contact with. And so we did an email, phone calls, and we only needed really 13 to kind of get an idea of where the plume was, and that's what that means.
So you, from the existing contact information, you were able to, in spatial context,
yes,
identify.
We selected several wells that would help us understand what the current status of the plume were. Mm-hmm. So we just reached out to several people, and there was 13 that did grant access again to resample, and those were sufficient in order to understand that the plume is stable.
Okay. And I'm just curious, I know we've had several updates on this, as the urgency of this has kind of driven a lot of effort to get, you know, to get informed on what's going on here. But do you think, I know you've had good success with the public meetings, do you feel that all of the residents that are impacted are aware that there's that level of awareness that their water may be contaminated?
It's a pretty high level of awareness. So staff have literally walked the precinct, so to speak, you know, done door-to-door knocks and multiple times, too. So I think the understanding and awareness is pretty high in that.
That's what I was
community.
Looking for.
Yeah.
Because it is a small area. I would think door-to-door would be the way to go. Okay, thank you.
Plus also to supplement a little bit, you know, the input from John is that it's sort of a little community by itself where they're located. Because,
right.
you know, they're across the airport, but so everybody knows everybody. And so I think there's, you know, good information.
That's a good point. That's clear in both of the public meetings we have, is there's a lot of intercommunication within the community, too. They know each other, and they talk about this, and clearly they've had very local conversation about this beyond our interaction with them.
Yes, and the other thing I want to point out, all of them have emails and very comfortable with the email correspondence.
Okay, I'm going to move on to the update on the 303D list. So on October 3rd, the State Water Board approved our 303D list along with a number of other regions. You might say, why did that take so long? Because we adopted that last December. It's because they were trying to batch them up. I think actually six different regions were incorporated in the action that the State Water Board took. So it's not just us that is feeding into that larger action by the State Board. And then at the December 2016 303D list item, so that's a year ago at this time, Central Coast board members asked about delistings, and this is in response to that. So the question focused on, are listings having an effect, a good water quality outcome ultimately, and what's the genesis of delistings? And so that is kind of spelled out here in the EO report. 20 of the, I believe it's 85, if I'm not, 83 delistings, 20 of them are the result of improved water quality. Some of them are, some of the additional or remaining 63 are the result of more data that suggests that maybe it shouldn't have been listed originally. And there are a variety of other reasons as to why listings were taken off or delisted. And that's spelled out in the EO report. Okay, and then moving on to a parallel story, the San Simeon Creek success story. And we alluded to this when we had the Cambria item 11, earlier today. Mary Hamilton of our staff highlights in this piece of the EO report the success in reducing nitrate loading to San Simeon Creek due to operational improvements at the Cambria Community Services District wastewater treatment plant. The graph at the bottom of page 6 shows on the far right side the precipitous drop in nitrate concentration. And that's the effect of a secant monitoring and subsequent conversations with the CSD about how they're operating their facility. And then the CSD is then taking action within how they're operating their facility and improving water quality. No TMDL. I mean, the TMDL was in development, but this action happened in advance of that. So it's a sort of a low-cost approach to improving water quality with the information.
Low cost to us. Okay.
And low cost to,
well, that's,
I
that's
think, ultimately to the CSD as well. It wasn't a large facility upgrade. It was, I'll call it tweaking, because I'm not an engineer and can't speak to the real terms. But you're an engineer, you can speak to the real terms. But I don't think it was at a high cost to them.
So my question is about that process. So during the period 2001 through 2015, when the nitrogen level was, you know, really much higher, what was going on in our dialogue then? I mean, did we were getting reports from the wastewater treatment operation.
Right, and they're a land discharge, and this is a surface water body, and I don't think we had established the connectivity at this point in time. As you look across that graph, I think mm-hmm. that's what's going on.
Okay.
At some point, we establish, oh, there's connectivity between that land discharge and that surface water impact. Okay, now, and it's a small watershed,
mm-hmm.
so there's not a lot of players in the watershed. So the math is actually pretty straightforward once you realize that the hydraulic connectivity exists.
Okay, now I understand. Thank you.
John, have we seen a less frequent occurrence of algal blooms, and are the conditions visibly more healthy for fish and aquatic animals? Does Mary have any observations that?
Mary, you wanna? Yeah, thank you. Mary Hamilton,
yeah.
Author.
Mary Hamilton with the monitoring assessment. We have noticed a lot of improvement there. There still was an algae bloom this summer, but I can say that by our professional opinion and the notes that we have documented at that site with photographs as well, it's visibly reduced from what we've seen in the past. We have seen complete blankets several inches thick of filamentous algae at those sites and complete stratification and anoxic conditions at the bottom of the lagoon there in the past, and that was not the case this year. The oxygen condition was better, less algae, and so we did see a visual improvement, but we haven't had enough data yet to do any statistical testing to say it's significantly better than previous years yet. We'll need a little more data, another year or so.
Now, this last occurrence, did we have elevated levels of nitrate?
We have not seen nitrate
yeah.
above 1 mg/L right. since October of 15.
So what do you think was causing that event?
So the WDR, the discharge to land permit, is for an area that's literally adjacent to the levees here, where the lower part of the creek is and the lagoon. And so we are certain that it's shallow groundwater and that there was just a leaching effect. And when they upgraded their discharge, when they upgraded the nitrate treatment in their discharge, it had almost an immediate effect. Within 2 months, we were seeing greatly reduced concentrations in the lagoon.
Mm.
Pretty awesome.
Yeah.
We were thrilled to see this data, and we're thrilled to see that it's continued for a year and a half now, so, or 2 years now, but.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Another plug for CCAM too.
So my question is, so we focused on it, you're saying, because we figured out there was a hydrologic connection between the pond and the lagoon. And before that, we were treating it as a discharge to land. And we're paying a lot of attention to discharges to land by agriculture that make it into groundwater. Are we paying a totally different kind of attention to discharges, to other sorts of discharges, nitrates and other sorts of discharges to land? I'm just curious. So
are you speaking to non-agricultural sources of
Correct.
Nitrate? Okay. Are we spending less attention? I would say no. I would say that we actually have a much higher attention with respect to nitrate at, say, wastewater treatment plants. Not in total,
uh-huh.
but in general. You know, it varies by the capability of the plant, by the capability of the district that manages the plant.
Because if it's a percolation pond, we're assuming it's percolating. If it wasn't percolating to the lagoon, it was percolating to groundwater. So I guess my question is, how you're saying we regulate that more highly with a sewage treatment plant?
MPDS, or in this case, MPDS. The WDR permit.
Okay, but so were we having or how do we regulate that as to the amount of nitrates in the effluent that's getting percolated then, and it was meeting those standards.
So here's where I'm going to have to punt to the individual case manager. That is John Rocky, as you know from earlier today. I, I can't speak to the compliance.
Yeah, it just seems weird that once we figured out the hydrologic connection to the lagoon, we got them to tweak their process and they fixed it. But before that, if we assumed it was percolating to groundwater, that we weren't asking them to fix the process.
So the Cambria Municipal Wastewater Treatment Plant does not have a nitrate limit in their discharge permit. Their discharge permit is fairly dated. I think it's circa year 2000. What really happened was they were running their emergency water supply system, and they exceeded the nitrogen limit in the discharge from that system. And the alarm bells went off, and we started looking around, trying to figure what is going on, where is this nitrogen coming from? And we determined it was coming from the municipal plant into their perk pond. And they.
The source of the water for the emergency.
Correct. We made them shut down the emergency water supply facility until they got the nitrogen under control. And at that time, they had a very creative chief plant operator up at the facility that said, hey, I want to try something. And he put in a portable pump and a hosing system and a baffle and a recirculation scheme, which is basically what they do in a more formalized way in most municipal plants to remove nitrogen. You provide an anoxic zone and then an aerobic zone, and biological denitrification occurs. So they were motivated by their emergency plant being shut down. So we immediately saw a big drop in the nitrogen numbers, and then we were really quite surprised to see how quickly that translated to the effects in the neighboring lagoon as well. So it was sort of a win-win.
Did they not have a nitrogen standard for their NPDES permit because we assumed it was going to some sort of groundwater that was going straight into the ocean, or?
I can't really testify as to why there was no nitrogen limit there, but they were doing monitoring, but there was no number they had to hit. And it's not an NPDES permit, it's a discharge to land.
A discharge to land, right, okay. So we don't necessarily regulate discharges to land more highly from sewage treatment plants for nitrate.
There are some of these old permits like Cambria's out there that when they become updated, we are definitely gonna focus on nitrogen. That's
okay.
A big emphasis of ours going forward.
Okay, any other questions on that success story?
No.
Okay, moving on. I think this is the last item in the EO report. This is a Salinas Basin Stewardship Group replacement water update, and this comes through in every EO report. This item provides a status report on the stewardship's efforts in providing replacement water in the Salinas Groundwater Basin agreement area. We're past the halfway point, and based on the table there, you can see there's a total of 20 systems that are receiving replacement water. And I'll contrast that against the September meeting table in the EO report, where there were 8 systems that were at that time served. So we're watching them make progress there. I also want to note that approximately 7 of those systems served were picked up from EJCW, Environmental Justice Coalition for Water, who is already serving bottled water to those systems. Ideally, we'd like to see acceleration here. You know, we're coming to the last third of year one of this process, and we'd like to see some sort of acceleration in the number of systems being served water, new systems coming online, or new services coming online. And Mr. Perry Clausen is here. Perry works on behalf of the stewardship group in his capacity with CURES. And Perry can maybe address that a little more about are we seeing increasing rates of service going on? And just as a reminder, the metric target for triggering a second year option in this agreement is 35 systems served.
Is there a target? I see that the gallonage is significantly different, 6,570 gallons delivered so far, and the year one target's 134,000 gallons. Is the only metric number of systems?
The only metric built into the agreement, yes. These others are kind of external metrics to try to establish other understandings, greater depth of understanding. So what does 35 systems mean? Or what does 20 systems serve mean in terms of gallonage or households, you know, to get a richer understanding of the data. Lastly, we emailed you and placed a copy in your folder of the stewardship agreement just for your information. We did this 8 months ago too, but this kind of provides us an opportunity as we're coming to the close of year one, and there's hope that there's a second year in this to help you understand what the expectations are inside year one and then ultimately in year two as well. Yes.
Some questions about how these numbers, what these metrics are telling us. We show number of individuals receiving replacement water as currently as 276, and then down below, number of domestic wells receiving replacement water opt in as zero. Is that a different target group?
Yeah, so the opt-in are, if I recall right, they're domestic wells that can opt into the process if they're determined to be above the drinking water standard.
And that would be different from the individuals, how?
The individuals could be, I think, could be coming from larger systems as well. So okay. This is the number of individuals that are receiving replacement water. Some of those individuals may live in non-domestic well water service households, if that makes sense. So they may be a slightly larger system, not a mm-hmm. single household, single well relationship.
But that system has been determined
to be what Drinking Water Division or County Environmental Health would call violation. That means they're above the safe drinking water limit for nitrate.
We're not talking about municipal. We're talking about
correct. We're talking about small systems,
greater
right,
than 15,
right, or even sub 15, yeah.
Sub 15, okay. And then we've got number of systems declining replacement water, and what kind of documentation, and what is the outreach associated with that?
So. This is a place where we intend to do a little more digging, for lack of a better term, to understand the nature of why the refusal happened here and to make sure that it is what the intent was and not something that interfered with the understanding of what the opportunity here for replacement water was.
Yeah.
You know, it's just validation of why they declined service. And okay. then Dr. Hunter Perry can probably offer you more firsthand account of what transpired associated with those six instances too, I think.
Yeah, I don't know if, hi Perry. I don't know if you were planning to make some comments, maybe I'll wait then.
Yeah, Mr. Clausen has a card in, yes.
Oh, then I will wait all my questions.
And I think that's all I have from my end on this item. I'll turn to Angela and ask if Angela wants to talk about any outreach or anything like that. This associated. So there's been a pretty complex outreach effort woven together between the State Water Board, Office of Enforcement, State Water Board, Office of Public Participation, and our office, and the county.
Right, so I guess this is in your staff report, but just to emphasize, following up on John's comments, that there is a fair amount of outreach that the water boards are engaged in to support the stewardship group and their contractor. Specifically, the Office of Public Participation, Marina Perez, and the Office of Enforcement, Angeles Calisa, both of which are bilingual, have dedicated a significant amount of time to doing a lot of outreach
some of them are described in your staff report, for example, the farm worker day. Another one that just occurred on December 2nd, which isn't in your staff report, is they spent the entire Sunday in Salinas at a women infant care, the WIC program, health outreach for migrant farm workers in the Salinas Valley. And similarly, we have provided funds to EJCW to do some contracted outreach to domestic well users. So very specific to that subset, the domestic well users, this is not a requirement for them to do, this is really to support the stewardship group in providing that level of outreach. And they're here today also.
And on this particular item, I have four speaker cards. So I will start with Perry, and you requested 5 minutes.
Thank you, Chair Wolf. I'm Perry Clausen, Executive Director of the Coalition for Urban Rural Environmental Stewardship. I had to pause there for a minute. With CURES is the acronym. We've been retained as the subcontractor to do the implementation on this project. Just a real brief overview, the Salinas Basin Ag Stewardship Group formed a limited liability company to implement this agreement with the state. They currently have, as of Tuesday, 77 members. And this is, as you know, it's like saying, how many growers do you have? Well, growers have a very different definition in the Salinas Valley than is what you would typically expect to call farmers. So there's 77 members, which represent 146 operators. So for instance, Driscoll, or I don't think Driscoll's in, but a shipper will have a lot of growers. So the shipper will join and then the growers will be included. So they have 77 members, 146 operations. Represented by those members, there's 162,000 acres represented out of about 180,000 acres in the Salinas Basin. The executive committee meets on a biweekly basis to talk about the adherence to the obligations set forth in the interim settlement agreement. So we started out on this project in March. We did a mailing of a total of 78, a list of 78. This included 44 systems from Monterey County Department of Health, the 2-to-15 hookups, plus a list of systems that were monitored under the GAMMA program. So we did two mailings, one in April 14, another in April 15, and immediately after the second mailing began calling every single name, myself, calling every single name on the county list, starting with a county list. We got through a couple of the GAMMA well names that we had phone numbers for and found out that their names were not supposed to be released to the public. So when you get a GAMMA well test, they have a confidentiality agreement with whoever pulls those samples, typically USGS. So we backed off on making any additional calls to them and per direction of the regional board. So we're focusing now, or have been focusing, on those 44 systems. So the number that's in your summary report is correct. So we contacted 20, or we have in under the program right now 20 systems with about 100, or excuse me, with approximately 100 residences in those systems. So one system can have multiple residents. They typically do. We have 100 residences, approximately 370 people, because the EJCW accounts that we inherited, we don't have occupant counts for those residences. We haven't got that number yet. So we have approximately 370 individuals, and deliveries to date total 6,550 gallons. This is as of about 2 weeks ago, so there's a little bit different from the report that we prepared for your EO report. Okay, out of those 20 systems, we've had out of the 44 systems, 9 are operated by SBASG members. So the agreement that SBASG has with those that participate they have to provide water to those residences. Many of them, and almost all of them, have been doing it already, or had been doing it before, and are doing that now. So we have 9 that are in the SBA SG. We have 8 that have declined to participate, and the reasons generally are we already have a system, we have an RO system, we don't need water, we're fine, we don't need you to participate, we don't need to have any water provided. We've had a number of people that have said, I don't want to get involved. They hear Monterey County, they hear State of Water, California, and they say, I don't want any part of this. In fact, when you do your follow-up, I would really like to be a little bird on somebody's shoulder when you talk to Melba Buckner. She's about probably late 70s, early 80s, and she was quite adamant that she didn't want me to call her anymore because she did not want to participate. So that's the kind of response that when they decline, they either are given water or I don't want to have anything to do with you. And this was after each of these have gotten anywhere from 2 to 6 calls from me over the last 4 months. So we check with everyone. Then we still have 3 that have not responded to calls, have not been home when myself or Sergio Sanchez, I should mention, he's working with us as well. I have a staffer, Adriana Aldana, who's bilingual. And she's, so we have 2 that are Spanish speaking. I don't speak Spanish, but from what the visits we've made, I would say less than half are bilingual. Most are Anglos. Okay, so we've had 3 that have not responded. We had 1, the well was below the nitrate standard. So we put that as an obligation that they had to be above the drinking water standard. We will be retesting that in 6 months. Believe it or not, we have still 3 people have not decided what they want to do yet, and I keep calling them periodically. We have 2 properties that sold. 1 was sold to a cannabis operation. I have not been able to get past the guard, and there's a 12-foot chain link fence around the place, and they have not called me back. The other one, the realtor refused to give us the property purchaser, and I believe it is a cannabis operation as well. So that's the status of those so far. And Ms. Hunter, did that answer your questions about the decline? So we're gonna be providing that list to Angelina and Angela. Oh, we got a lot of A's. So I'm gonna be providing those ones that declined, and then there will be some follow-up by them as well.
So you mentioned the number 44.
Yes.
And that would apply to
44.
I see a total of 58 for the number of potential water systems. So I'm just curious where 44 comes from.
44 were on the list for Monterey County Health.
Okay.
So then the 78, that was Gamma plus the 44 plus the Gamma wells.
What's 58? 58 is listed on this table. Do we know?
Not sure.
Mom, John, or Angela? Okay.
So that, as Perry mentioned, it's the Gamma plus the Monterey County Small Water Systems equals the 58.
Perry, you just probably misspoke and said 78 instead of 58, or yeah. Did you mean 78?
I don't have that number on here. I'm doing it for, 58, sorry.
Oh, it's 58. Okay,
yeah.
I just wanted to track
what
you were saying.
In my
So with all the... What would you say, just ballpark, do you feel that you have reached or in some way contacted with information about the program more than half, 2/3 of the potential system operators?
Well,
where are you in that?
All the Monterey County 44, they've got 2 applications. They've had 2 mailings and lots of calls from myself. I have a log of every time I call them. And we've had visits, they've all been contacted, the 44. Mm-hmm. The balance, the Gamma, we stopped because we gotta get that straightened out, the confidentiality. I had one person that was a little upset as to how the heck you get my name. So you gotta get that figured out.
So is that something that can be worked out with Monterey County since they have the agreement with Monterey County?
I'm turning to Angela on that. I think that was, you were talking about USGS going back to get some
USGS is going to step in?
Yeah, They're the ones that did the sampling. They are, I believe they need to be the ones to do that.
They have the agreement.
Yes.
Yeah, they have the agreement. So do you think that, I mean, personally, I would like to see this program renewed.
Okay,
and
so
you have a criteria,
yeah,
you know, it hits.
Let me keep going here a little bit.
Okay,
so then the Office of Public Participation has this hotline. It's been good. We've gotten 35 calls on it. However, they don't qualify. And I would categorize many of them as they live in town and they don't like the water they're drinking. It tastes horrible, so they see this program and they apply and we Google their address and they're right in the middle of Greenfield. So we tell them, we try to screen them and say, do you get a water bill? And some don't pay the water bill. No, I don't. Well, somebody else in the house pays the water bill. And we get, and there's others that don't know about that provision. Somebody saw it on Facebook and they applied. And we had, in fact, we had three that were, that came off of somebody's Facebook that said, hey, I got free water, you ought to apply to this. So out of that, we've got one small system that wasn't even on Monterey County that we have one residence that's getting water, and we just got the two other residences applications in a couple of days ago. So that program, that's an option for people to contact through the flyers that the meetings that Angela mentioned. There's also flyers at the health department. They're going to churches or going to other places to try to get people to apply through that way. And then at the EJCW, which you all are here, they're doing some efforts as well. And also when we go out to a system, when Adriana goes out to a system, she talks to the people. We got to get permission, obviously, to sample the well again. She brings applications along. She's her own little outreach machine out there trying to find people. See some of the other things that we've done. We had a grant previously with the regional board. We've taken over those systems and added them as individuals from that previous regional board grant to CURES. So then that leads to year two strategy. CURES put a proposal together for SBASG. They're considering it right now on how we're gonna find the rest of the people that are not on cities, not on irrigated lands program, not in this program, and not being served. We've got a methodology. We think we'll find out who's out there that may need water, plus the effort that EJCW is doing.
So I want to mention that this plan that Perry references is also inside the agreement. That's part, getting that plan developed and approved is part of the qualifier for the second year. And I was going to ask Perry, do you have any sense when we at Central Coast or Office of Enforcement at State Board would see that plan?
So this has been an interesting group to work for. I am very put into the implementation component. I was told that they are going to be talking to Chris Kerrigan in the next few weeks. But that's the Gillis group that does that work, and I think he works with Michael and John on that. So I proposed it to them. I heard that it was good for them, so now they're setting up. I believe they're trying to set up a meeting to get that move forward.
So let me ask you this, Perry. When the water is provided, 5 gallon at a time?
No, it's depending on how many people are in the household. So we have Culligan that does twice a month delivery. We also took over the delivery agreement with DGW that was set up by EJCW. So we just, they already had those all set up. So we just pay the bill. And I believe they're on a twice a month twice a month delivery, and the way these companies work, my understanding is that we deliver them the bottle, whatever they think they need for 2 weeks, and then they come back every 2 weeks and they set out the empty bottles, and then whatever's empty, that's how many they leave each time they go.
Right, because what I did is a very simple math, and I assumed that, you know, when we say bottled water, they get like
five gallon, yeah.
Okay, because of the weight limitation.
Right.
So simple math, I took the 6,570 gallon, I divided that by five gallons. Mm-hmm. So that gave me 1,314 5 gallon bottles. Mm-hmm. I assumed you have a house with two people, so you would need, 5 gallon a day. So that's divide by 7. So that gives 187 weeks worth of bottled water.
Okay, so let me stop.
Single entity. So tell me where my math is.
Okay, so think of it as we had 2 homes the first week. Second week we had 5 homes. Now we have 20. So it built.
Oh, okay.
So we have deliveries this week, this month, that are far greater than the beginning of the program. So it's built. It's been building on itself. So that it does that math that you're talking about doesn't work quite well. But what the point being is that we deliver the amount of water they need. We don't say you get 5 and that's it.
But
so if they need more, they get more.
Yeah.
In fact, we've had a couple of businesses that said that's not enough, so we ended up doubling. In fact, I didn't mention that. There's several businesses that are part of these systems.
Because, you know, the water is not only for drinking, it's for cooking also.
Right, and that's explained. It's
so if I drinking. Still, though, I, you know, I read what you're saying about the ramping up, but if we take the totality of the gallons, that mm-hmm. translates to 187 weeks worth of 5 gallon a day, you know, water provided. And then you mentioned there were 370 individuals total.
Right.
So does that mean that you may have residents where you have 2 individuals or 3?
Oh, yeah, sure. They're okay. All over the place. Yeah. And one business has 40 people. And how much do they use in a business?
I was just thinking that maybe that total gallonage that you have may be underestimated.
That's how much we take that off of our invoices.
So. Based on what, you know, you're saying in the number of individuals, it doesn't pencil out, that number would be higher.
So that number total includes the employees at those businesses. So what, you know, what's consumed at a business?
Well, what's your monthly gallonage now? Do you know that?
I didn't come. Yeah, I could prepare those sort of details if need be. I mean, we're providing the amount of water that's needed. I mean, really, we're not saying you're limited. We tell Culligan, we don't tell them how much to deliver. It's deliver what they need in that household. Mm-hmm. DGW is the same way.
But so are they contacted in at an intermediary time in that 2-week period? Are they able to, if they run out of water within those 2 weeks?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, we've and we're leaving it to the vendor. The Culligan is instructed, if somebody needs more water, provide them the water. And then, you know, reflect in your invoice. So, I mean, we're planning to go back, call everybody again. How's it going? You got any problems? There's the evaluation, it says how many complaints. I've heard no complaints yet. We did have, some of the startups have been a little bit bumpy for reasons, just Culligan calling the person that needs to be delivered, they're not home, why didn't, you know, they just cross paths, but that's the only complaints. We had a couple of startups were a little rough getting them going, but once the water starts delivering, then it seems to be going well.
So it sounds like the contract to Culligan is effective and efficient.
Yeah.
So good, once people get connected into the program and get listed for regular water deliveries, that's working out. But so, far as the current outreach efforts to build the numbers relative to what we suspect in terms of how many people should be or how many people are eligible to receive replacement water, what's the process outside of your staff outreaching through churches or through events? I think you said Adriana.
Yes.
Is she based in the...
She's based in Davis. So let me explain.
Okay.
So my instructions as a subcontractor is to fulfill and contact the people that were in the agreement. That's it. She does the outs. When she goes someplace, she talks to people like I mentioned. But as far as the individual outreach, that comes from the state board's efforts. Phase 2 goes, the second year goes into the beyond this list of systems.
And in phase 2,
And that starts in March.
And that's a good point, that you're, you know, that this whole process is being supported with this additional work by the Office of Public Participation, and now
right.
we have EJCW. So
yes.
in, if you were to go into the second year, would your program take over more substantively that outreach effort? Would there be a need to have a staffer based in the region?
Well, I'm under kind of a tight leash with this group. They said, let's wait until the proposal goes to the state and the region before you talk about it. Mm-hmm. So I'm gonna leave it there.
And so how did the arrangements to get you additional outreach support occur? Because I think the whole idea is the stewardship group is creating this model for, at least this is my interpretation, I'm sure this is not articulated in the agreement, but it's relatively a new concept to create a model where landowners can pool resources of different sorts, including monies,
right.
to issue replacement water. And part of that is conducting the outreach. But now in the actual implementation of that, we see state resources through staffing and now a grant to EJCW augmenting that agreement.
Mm-hmm.
So how will that look in year two? You can't count on that to occur in year two, right?
Right,
okay.
Yeah. So I think we need to wait to get that worked out first before I can speculate on that.
I see, but it's a, I guess I'm just trying to make sure you understand. It's
oh, sure.
It's a factor that
oh, yeah.
that we would see in your plan
mm-hmm.
coming forward, how you would fill that gap, right?
My goal as an organization is to make sure that Salinas Basin has water where it's needed. That's the way I came into this. I was given a list to start with from the agreement.
Yeah. Yeah.
Phase two is to finish that.
Yeah, I would just end it by saying I think I've made myself clear about where my interests are in terms of that outreach,
sure.
that your plan from your group include how you will address the additional work that's going on
yes.
now, how that will be taken care of.
We are
going
to take a very tactical
yeah.
approach to making sure every home that's not on a water, public waters, PWS, my new term,
uh-huh.
everybody that's not on a PWS or in this program already, will have an opportunity to take advantage of this program.
Okay, all right, thank you.
And also, so
that's
you
my
know,
promise. I will. We will make sure.
And also, so you know, EJCW has also 5 minutes, and you know, is going to further
yes, sorry
augment.
For going
on here. No okay. worries. You know, augment the information. That way, we hear all the different
sure.
components. So, you know, I'd like to hear from, you know, the rest of the speakers, and then we, you know, may ask you
sure.
to,
no, that's fine.
You know, give some additional input, but I'd like to hear from EJCW now,
okay.
and then certainly we'll bring you back to the podium as needed.
I think I covered all my points. Okay, thank you.
Perfect. So, Moreno Rivera, please. And you are the coordinator.
Mm-hmm. Right. Good evening, members of the board. My name is Moises Moreno Rivera, and I am the new Central Coast Program Coordinator for the Environmental Justice Coalition for Water at our Salinas office. Prior to joining EJCW in October, I obtained my master's degree from the University of Florida, focusing on crimes against humanity at the crossroads of environmental justice in Mexico, where persons there have been disappeared by the government to gain control of the water and other natural resources. Water and human rights issues are a global phenomenon, and that's what brings me here today. In September of this year, EJCW signed a grant agreement with the Central Coast Water Board to conduct focused community outreach in the Salinas Valley Basin with a specific purpose to increase community participation and domestic drinking well, drinking water well testing and opportunities to receive safe drinking water under the Salinas Valley Basin Free Clean Drinking Water Program. This is an important interim solution for communities facing nitrate and other contaminants in excess of the drinking water standard. Today I will present highlights of EJCW's involvement in the process. The first highlight, presentations to community groups in eligible areas. So building on the outreach foundation developed by the State Water Board, the Office of Public Participation, and the Office of Enforcement, EJCW has been able to conduct focused outreach to faith-based groups and community groups. In October, EJCW, in conjunction with the State Water Boards, participated in a church outreach event at St. John the Baptist Catholic Church in King City. Earlier this year, the State Water Board obtained approval from the Catholic Diocese of Monterey to provide brief announcements during Mass and invite parishioners to visit an information table at the end of Mass. At this event, we were able to inform 300 parishioners about the program, provide bilingual information, speak to over 60 persons one-on-one, distribute bilingual informational flyer, identify and complete application process for potentially qualified individuals, and check whether community members were eligible for enrollment using GeoTracker. Highlight number two, social media. In November, I met with a local community advocate, the new project director for Thriving Immigrants Collaborative, to brainstorm different methods of outreach that could help expand knowledge of the program. Facebook came to mind. Thankfully, earlier in the fall, the State Water Board Office of Public Affairs and Office of Public Participation developed a pilot bilingual Facebook page with targeted outreach, a toll-free number to call, and video PSAs to inform remote rural residents of the program. Building upon existing foundation provided by the state, I shared a new post under my personal Facebook account linking the state Facebook page. I encouraged the project director of Thriving Immigrants Collaborative to share my post. She too encouraged local community advocates to do the same, and they did. With the assistance of my personal post and community collaborations, the State Water Board's page increased its views from hundreds to thousands. As of last week, the page has over 7,466 views, and each PSA video has been watched over 1,000 times. Under the personal post, I included my number and email, and since then, I have received 3 Facebook messages, over 40 calls, and 4 emails. The Office of Enforcement also stated that their calls increased after the post. Social media allows us to reach populations that we otherwise could not have using traditional forms of communication. The last highlight is networking. Under EJCW's list of local contacts that have established support for the program, we were able to expand our list earlier this month, where I joined the State Water Board at a health fair in Hartnell College, as Angela mentioned earlier. At the conference, we spoke to over 50 people and networked with community organizations to gather local support for the program. 3 contacts that will benefit our program out of that networking. So the first one is the program's coordinator for the food bank at Monterey County has invited me to attend food delivery dates to present to recipients of the program, which all the recipients are low-income households. The second partner is the King City High School parent coordinator invited me to present to the parents in January and has given me the contact information for the parent coordinator at Greenfield High School and the superintendent to do outreach to parents at the local high schools. And 3, the manager of migrant education program for the Monterey County Office of Education, and I will meet in the coming weeks to find different ways of collaboration. They have a reach of over 36,000 farm workers and are one of the few organizations with access to agricultural fields in the Salina Valley Basin with some limitations. As the board knows, the outreach and education to domestic well users is part of a larger body of work, including EJCW's collaborative, regional, and local project planning for long-term solutions, in addition to advocacy to address the root causes of the nitrate problem. We thank the board for its continued support for various facets of EJCW's work, this project included. We thank Angeles from the State Board Office of Enforcement and Marina from the State Board Office of Public Participation for their partnership. And we are happy to respond to any questions the board may have at this time.
Well, your timing is impeccable.
Practice before coming.
I can tell, congratulations. So I have a quick question for you because, you know, you I took the example where you were able to successfully outreach at a church event, and based on Perry's input, basically the qualification is limited to the enrollees in the program. Correct, Perry? So there must then be some folks who says, yeah, I'm interested, but they don't qualify because they're not within the geography of the enrollees from grower standpoint. So then, we have situation of folks who have drinking water which is in exceedance of a safe standard. What's kind of the answer to them? Is it like, sorry, can't help you? I mean, they still have potential health issues of drinking unsafe water, and is there, some kind of a backup plan to at least say, you're not eligible for this free bottled water replacement program, but you do have, health risk if you continue drinking that unsafe water?
So to address that question, specifically at King City, when we were there at the church, there's two things that came to mind. So one of them was there's people who know they get their water from a well, that they know that their water could very much be contaminated, and they do might qualify for their income and all the other requirements. However, there's been, and Marina told me this in an email earlier yesterday as I was sharing this information with her, is the political climate around immigration has been an issue. So there's people who are afraid that the farm grower that provides their water or that where they live, their tenant could very much either have them deported or they could be evicted. So we have those situations where they meet the requirements, but then they back off because of that situation. The other issue is we have domestic well users that they're afraid of getting their well tested because of the cost that could come after the fact. So we've had, at the same church, we had somebody who came up to me and was like, well, my domestic well does provide water to other people, and I do fall within this area. My income's too high, so then we took down his name, but then he's like, but I don't want to get tested because I don't want to be tainted, and I don't want to face the ramifications of the state coming down on me in the future. So they refused to give information in that sense. So those were two of the experiences of that I face to face that I came across, where those are some of the limitations. Does that address part of your question?
Yeah, it does. And please go ahead.
If I may add, so the Facebook page, what we realized, the resharing, it was a very safe way for people to obtain that information in the comfort of their home. There's two pages. There's one in English and there's one in Spanish. So what I did, when you have the state putting a page out, you're not going to go up to the page and look, hey, let me look up the state and let's see what they're doing, right? Especially when the political climate right now, nobody really who's undocumented would want to see what the government's doing and how they could be affected. However, when you share a personal post, when it's a community advocate telling you about this program and sharing the links with you and sharing the information of the state and the settlement agreement, and you're sharing this information and you personalize it, where you find the different approach, it's still a Facebook post and they're still clicking on those links, but it's more, it's a personal touch where it's not as intimidating. So that's the approach that the community advocate told me. You should do a personal post. Put it on your page. Make it public. Have people from the local community share it. And that's what we did. And that's how, in a matter In a matter of less, it was less than a week, the post was shared over 280 times. It was shared over 280 times, and those shares led from the page being seen in the thousands. And the increase in calls have happened. The calls that I did receive, some of them were thank you calls. People calling just to say, thank you so much that you're doing this. I do have family in Chular. We do have family in Gonzales. I'm gonna share this with them. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the contact that we have had has been that. And hopefully because of the networking that we have been able to do, so if we're not successful in enrolling people at events, what we are successful at is building those community partnerships, and especially the King City parent coordinator at the high school, where she's like, I have this possibility that you could just come to talk to the parents directly. And the first question she asks is like, do you speak Spanish? And I said, yes, I do, it's my first language. I was like, okay. So we're gonna have a Spanish session and we're gonna have an English session. That way the parents who speak Spanish feel comfortable in and just addressing you in Spanish, and the other folks could address you in English, and there's no people whose questions go unanswered. So that's what we're gonna plan to do starting January, where these meetings are being set up.
And in terms of direct collaboration and communication with Perry,
how
both of you communicate?
I don't mind any sort of collaboration and contacting with Perry. At this point, my point of contact has been Marina from the Office of Public Participation,
mm-hmm.
and Angeles from the Office of Enforcement. And all of my communication has been with them. And the events that I've done, we have direct communication. I know I can pick up the phone and I call them and they answer. So when I was gonna bring these comments to you today, the first person that I called was Marina. And I was like, Marina, we've collaborated. This is what we've done. And this is what I'm gonna share. And she gave me her points. So that's why this collaboration has been fruitful. And I don't see why EJCW cannot find a way to work with Perry to see how we could get more people enrolled. Because at the end of the day, it's about the people.
Yeah, that's the end goal.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. And, you know, go ahead, Monica, and then Mike and whoever.
Okay, I'll start. Mike, would you like to go?
Sure. I'm just curious. So it's pretty easy, I would assume, on GeoTracker to take a look at an address and see if it's in or out of the covered area, because it's basically the Salinas Valley minus the folks that are served by public water systems. Is that correct?
Right, it is easy to see, it's time consuming. So when you're at an event with 300 people and you have two or three people trying to see it, it is easy to see, it's just time consuming.
Well, what I wonder is this, I'm just wondering if there's a way to take lists. I'm always thinking of lists. So we've got, for example, that parent coordinator in King City or in Greenfield has lists with addresses, probably. And in a more automated way, be able to take that list and eliminate the addresses that are served by public water systems, just leaving the addresses that would be in your target area. And I could think of any number of other ways to get my hands on lists with trusted messengers, you know. For example, an ag employer that wants to make sure that their employees get access to this, you know, if they're living in those areas. If you had an automated way to just compare those lists, take a couple, you know, you could then get a list of addresses to start contacting, and a lot of those folks will have phone numbers. If it's an employer, they're going to have contact phone numbers. If it's a union, they're going to have contact phone numbers. And that might be a different way to do some outreach. And you could probably also, in an automated way, strike off the people that are already being served. Because you'll have those by address too, I would assume. Especially if you're coordinating with Perry.
Thank you for that.
And I would be happy to talk with you afterwards about some thoughts of where you might be able to look for some of those lists. But there's lots of folks that have lists. Every church has a list of their parishioners, for example, or at least of some portion of their parishioners.
I think the only concern there is, well, we have to first establish those relationships, right? So
that's correct. You have to have relationships, but through Perry, you have an avenue to relationships with some of the ag folks, and certainly they would have to make sure that, you know, there weren't confidentiality problems. But I think that's probably doable, and I have some other thoughts as well we can talk about.
Thank you.
Oh, by the way, some of those ag producers might also be willing to let you talk with their workers, either in the harvesting crews or at the start or end of the day.
Go ahead, Perry.
Okay, right now about 95% of growers in Salinas Valley are in Salinas Mason Ag Stewardship Group. They have to provide water to all of their workers. So I understand that's a good idea, but what I'm saying is if there's anybody, any farm worker out there that's not getting water, I think they're going to be swept up by some letters that are coming out of.
If they're living on that farmer's property.
On any farm's property. If any agricultural land has houses on
it. So what we're looking for is the people who are out of the public water systems and not necessarily on farm property.
That are on rural residences.
That are on rural residences. Yeah. That's correct. So what my thought was, some of those people might be employees of these farms. And that's what I was thinking of them in terms of their employee relationship, not in terms of their residing on these farms.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. So I'll just give you a little hint that phase two is going to include what you just talked about.
Okay, so
good.
I just have a couple comments. I wanted to thank you both for your work. I think it's tremendous that you're, you know, reaching out to the community in their languages, and it's really important to sweep everybody up in this process and ensure that they're getting water. It sounds like, you know, you both have done a tremendous job at maybe just marrying your efforts and communicating. It doesn't sound like there's been the dialogue between.
Angeles and I talk.
Okay.
We talk
awesome.
All the time.
Okay, so then those 18,000 acres will be covered and everyone will be served. Okay, thank you. Appreciate all your work. I guess just so schools, I think, are the best way to outreach to people and building those relationships, whether they're, you know, with PTA organizations or everybody has kids, lots of people have kids, and oftentimes, you know, kids are a little bit more open and can help, you know, foster relationships with parents, and so those things are really helpful.
Pleasure to meet you, Moises. I was interested in the networking aspect and kind of on the lines of what Mr. Johnston suggested. I know that EJCW has been building relationships and alliances over the last several years. We've been really grateful to see EJCW being able to put people on the ground in the communities. And so I'm glad to see that it's, you know, you're moving the process into areas that touch on everyday life, you know, not just looking at places where people are going to be thinking about just the water, because there are many needs that are being met by community-based organizations, especially in the Monterey County area. I worked myself for a while with a group that's no longer in place, but it was a health-focused group that, again, those that networking and alliances is really the avenue in because they're so wired in, but they're not aware of the water issue. And I will give you my experience just really briefly. I was there working on water issues in Salinas and worked with CHISPA and worked with this other group that was a health, Monterey County Health Consortium. And I was based there and had an office there, in, you know, embedded with another group. And they were working on housing, they were working on health, they were working on employment issues. Eventually, we started to talk about the water dimension, and they had no awareness. They didn't even understand how the water system works, you know, whether it's private wells or municipal water systems and so forth. And they didn't understand what recourse they had when they did understand that people were drinking contaminated water. So I think a lot of it is working at that higher level and networking and educating, helping to educate the advocacy community. And I'm guessing that you're encountering that, and churches being a big part of the social, meeting social needs, you know, and connecting people to these services. So I really applaud what you're doing. I'm so grateful that EJCW is in place and can take this on, you know, with all the work. And Heather, I know we've talked about the broader range of issues, but and how water fits in and where it pops up, you know, and where you can make these connections and build on work that's already been going on for decades. So, and I'm, you know, we have had a couple conference calls, just, you know, brainstorming on these issues. So I'm looking forward to having a chance to talk with you further about your work. But it sounds like you really, and moving through social media is really quite exciting. I'm glad to hear that is a new dimension. So it's great.
Thank you.
So I know Mayor Delgado has a question too, but I still have two speaker cards because this may trigger some additional questions. Do you want to wait?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'll start with, since you stood up.
I don't have any comments, and Annie had to leave, so you don't have any.
You don't have any comment? Oh, my goodness. Okay, I'll put this in your emotional bank account, 3 minutes for future use.
I'll
go in your saving account.
Okay, thank you.
All right. So,
she'll use it.
I know she will, but that's all right. Fair is fair. So, Bruce, go ahead.
Thank you, Moises, for being here today and the work you've done. You're quickly becoming the expert in what you're doing, where you're doing it, as far as communicating, outreach. And I just want to make sure that we help you to the extent that we can. I more understand what Perry is doing because it's kind of a linear link. He goes to the property owners that have wells serving non-public water supply residents. And I'm less understanding what you're doing. So I think you're giving outreach to people so that they can find Perry, so at least they know that that process exists within the stewardship group area. Is that your primary role, or what is the product that you see yourself giving the community?
So EJCW was tasked to do mainly outreach and support the work of CURES. So one of the things, the way I see the work is community education and outreach go hand in hand. And when I go, the meetings that we have had, the outreach events that we have had, the one-on-ones with organizations that we have had, all have gone to building the networks to inform the person that could be off social media in a rural community that's not being provided water. So unlike calling property owners, we're more about filling up those gaps and filling those holes where the traditional forms of communication sometimes cannot work, where you do send a mailer and it bounces back, where you do try to do phone banking and the numbers aren't working or the person has moved. And that has happened when we do calls ourselves. So when you are at a community event with a trusted institution, let's say a school, and community members who are very much qualified can trust you because they trust the school and they brought me over, or they brought EJCW over. That's the role that we're trying to the play, filling the holes of where traditional forms of communication and contact have not worked.
Is it all about trying to find those who have unsafe drinking water and giving them the information they need to attempt to get onto replacement water, or is there a broader mission?
Well, there's both. There's education, right? The educating about the effects of public health and educating the community about the program and walking them through the process. We do have the CURE sign-up forms. I do have access to GeoTracker. I do have access to enroll someone and to pass that information to Angeles so that she could cross-reference to see if they are eligible and enroll them. So we're doing both. When I have gone with the state, when I have gone to do outreach, we always have those forms there. But sometimes people do not want to enroll there and then. They want to learn more about it. They want to talk to their kids about it. If the information's in Spanish, a lot of the times the community members that we interact with, even as we try to put the language that's more accessible, still sometimes they cannot understand it. So they want to be able to take that home and be in the comfort of their home to do it. And if we are building those community relationships and we are going to places where they do feel comfortable, and they do feel comfortable talking to me there and then, we need to be in places where people feel comfortable. We cannot just assume that because we're gonna call or because we're providing a service, they wanna do it. You know, we cannot assume those things. We have to be able to take different approaches to see what works in one community may not work for another. So we have to be proactive in finding those different ways to fill those holes.
So is it one, you're providing general education about water health issues, and two, specific information about how they can get replacement water if their water isn't compliant with law, with
yes,
our metrics?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Can I just add? I mean, I think it's also important. I mean, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think your role is also to build up trust with these communities, right? And to maybe help build up some of the capacity and give them tools beyond what they have right now to advocate for themselves. Is that part and parcel of what you're imparting?
Yeah, so one of the things is when we do go to community events is when we go talk to, when the state talked to the diocese and we went to the church to present at the church, the priest was like, oh, I learned something new, right? So I know that around this area there could be some parishioners that are being affected. So it was a community leader providing that support and guiding them to our table. And he was standing by us and welcoming people over. So that is part of what we're doing.
Yeah, because the state as a whole, governance as a whole, is intimidating. And so it's important to make it accessible, and having people help you through that process is important. So the services that you're providing are really critical, overall to the mission that we have and the mission that you have.
I actually was, I'm Heather Lucas again. I work with Moises. We're very lucky to have him. I think you all can tell by now. The issue of trust is something I wrote down, and some of the apprehension that we had actually in coming into this agreement was based around trust. And we have spoken with Angela Schroeder about this and made some requests. I personally think, confidentiality, written in, legal confidentiality among all parties would go a long way. Not requiring names, perhaps, but confidentiality with CURES, with the stewardship group, with the water vendors, with us. I think that in this climate, political climate, it's a real issue. And when Anjali's at the State Water Board and Marina got this feedback too, and they put a big thing on the top, they modified their form that says, you will not be reported to immigration. But I said, what's the legal backup for that? What's the justification for that? If I read it, who is saying this to me? And I read it and I said,
I don't know. You know, I mean, how would I, like, if I were in that position, and we have direct relationships with people who've been in that position in other cases, and it wasn't, you know, enforced or respected. So I think we came with that question, and I think to really grow this, it needs to be addressed. And there's some simple things in place that could be done, as I understand it.
Hold on. You know, I think, frankly, that we refer to the political climate, agreed, but we have five separate organizations involved in this program, okay? And I would look at it as there is a need in phase two to have a little more congruence. Specifically, you know, you're working, and I'm referring to the challenges perhaps that you have and the challenges that Perry have. We're working with Gita's group out of Sacramento. So that's one. Office of Enforcement, you mentioned. That's a whole separate entity with, you know, they're all their own agenda. Two. Three, we have a stewardship group. That's their own entity, their own board. Three. Four, we have CURE. You heard Perry saying, you know, I'm on a leash. I can do only X, Y, Z. So that's four. And then five is your organization. And I think there is an organizational challenge in how, you know, having all these wheels, all these wheels turning in the same direction. And, you know, I realize it took a bit of a time for this program to get up to speed, but I think to be successful, there's gonna be a need for, you know, a little closer engagement. And I'm just being very candid here, is that, yeah, you know, I hear all the issues on how you reach out, the trust, et cetera. That's absolutely correct. These are, you know, some of the barriers to success. But I'm looking at more as organizational structure, and, you know, if I'm a grower and I'm signing up in this program, you know, there has to be, you know, something a little more collaborative as a whole. And I'm not saying, you know, you're looking at each other's in the groups with suspicions and concerns, but I would, that's just my view. I think there's a need to get everyone working collaboratively a little bit more to, you know, to help each other being successful. And, you know, you're the boots on the ground, and, you know, I'm not taking an ounce away from your efforts. You know, in fact, the reason I mentioned this is to kind of share my view of some of the, you know, the organizational challenges with this whole program. And, you know, because you have some groups who are like, wow, you know, this is Office of Enforcement, you know, and they're after me, you know, and then you have your end to say, oh yeah, but we're here in a certain status in the US and we're concerned with some other agencies. You've got a lot of these push and pull moving parts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I mean, these are very fragile relationships, and they're obviously, it takes a long time to develop. But I do agree that there needs to be a look again. I'm off of this thing, sorry. These are fragile relationships, and it really takes a lot of time, but I do think that we all need to be collaborative and working together and on the same page as to what the aims are. So I agree with you.
Just to, I was waiting. Well, I just want to reiterate the networking dimension, because I know EJCW has not been on the ground as long as some of the other community needs, you know, organizations. And but I think they would welcome the opportunity to add another resource, some additional tools, but you need to educate them about it. That's what I was getting at before. But they have the trust, because they are serving at the neighborhood level, and are integrating across medical, nutrition, education, jobs. They really are looking at basic fundamental family needs. And once I had a chance to talk with these different advocates about how water fits into that picture and what recourse people had to address their water needs or water potential health impacts of water, drinking unsafe water, they could see immediately how it fit in, but the awareness isn't there. So I just think, I realize this, we're trying to keep this narrow to the work at hand, but there could be some gains there made pretty quickly because once you can convince them of the urgency of this, they would, open the door to establish trusted relationships where they know, regardless of their status, regardless of their residency, this group has been servicing their needs for quite some time.
So,
just one quick comment on that. At the day before Moises started, I went to a meeting with the other staff that have been mentioned with a group like this that serves all the South County, a lot of direct service groups. Mm-hmm. And it was those representatives that said, who will have this information?
Yeah.
We'll go build the trust, but we want to know who's going to get these names. How is it going to be protected? You tell us.
Right.
So that's, that was what came right from those very people. You know, they want that. And then once that's there, they will open up. And they're already opening up to Moises and others because, it just sort of comes, there can be that. But I think there's actually a functional, it's an ask, too, to just help get that in place so that other things can proceed. But I agree with you. That's 100% what I thought, too. And I think why his work has been effective in building the relationships.
Yeah. Well, this is another piece of the platform that's been coming together through the work of BJCW and will serve, as we go forward, will serve through other ways that we are looking at the needs of disadvantaged communities more generally as it relates to, water issues, water supply, clean water, et cetera. So, all of this is building in a very good direction, and I anticipate that it will, the pace of this will definitely accelerate as you start to get more established.
So
one more comment for Perry's. Perry's second phase will help too. So just saying.
Okay. Just for order here, Mike had a question, and Bruce has patiently waiting.
Okay, right, just a comment. I mean, the large majority of farm workers in the Salinas Valley are undocumented. And so, yes, of course, they and organizations that work with them are, I don't think paranoid is the word when there really is somebody after you. It's those questions of confidentiality are very important. But I have to say, I spent most of my adult life working for labor unions that represented farm workers and dealing with the agriculture industry. So I understand the issues of building trust. It can be really difficult. And certainly, in the process of doing all of this work around regulating the irrigated lands program over the last some years, there's been a lot of distrust by ag of the environmental justice folks and vice versa. But on the issue of protecting people from deportation, you guys are so much on the same page as the agricultural industry that it's just not funny. I mean, the different than, conservative folks in most of the country, if you talk to farmers of any political stripe in the Salinas Valley, they are very into protecting the labor force from the potential of deportation. So, I agree it is important. With what other board members have said, it is important to find ways to strengthen the direct communication between what you guys are doing and what Perry's doing. But I think if you, and the ask you're making is not unrealistic. You want to be able to show people this is what guarantees that your names aren't going to be given to somebody who's looking to deport them. Okay, that's huge to people. But I think if you talk to the folks that Perry is working with, you will find them to be quite sympathetic to that ask, because I think that's an issue on which there's not a lot of airspace between you and them.
All right, so I think this was a good conversation that we had. It's an informational item, no action step to be derived. I think you heard from all of us. We thank both of you for your time, and also we thank you, Perry. There's some quantitative measurable goals that have to be achieved, and we need, we discussed a lot of how, but bottom line, these are targets that have been painfully, in a very lengthy way, negotiated with Office of Enforcement, and some of these terms are out of our hand because they fall under the Office of Enforcement. So, I think time is of essence to make progress, and again, I will further emphasize the importance of collaboration with all the parties I listed. And John, you have additional input to close this item?
Yeah, just one closing thought.
Thank you.
Thank you, folks. We will update you again in February, so this is not your last crack at this story. This is a continuing story. Okay, moving on.
So we move on to the last item of
the
day.
Actually, I have a couple more snippets in the EO report.
Oh, and remorse.
Yeah, they're invisible in the EO report. They're just spoken, not written. I have an update on Elkhorn Slough, the sediment erosion site we've spoke of at the Santa Barbara meeting most recently, September. Circling back to that discussion in September, we're planning to provide an update on this via either my EO report or through a standalone item. We delayed this item to fit with the location of the February board meeting, which is Watsonville. It made no sense to try to do that item here because of the location. And then the other item I have, that's it on the erosion, just letting you know, signaling to you, teasing you that it'll be in the next EO report or an individual item.
And I appreciate you bring that up, because that was a specific request from us, is to give us updates.
Right.
Thank
and
you.
I'm trying to close the loop and let you know we haven't lost the thread. We also want to do it, though, in a geography that makes sense, closest to Elkhorn Slough. Last item in the EO report is I wanted to address climate change and WQCC just briefly. In follow-up to the WQCC panel on climate change, in the first half of the next year, we will have an item that looks at actions already in play in this region in response to climate change, and actions we are teeing up, i.e. the highest priority item in the triennial review list, as an example of things that we're teeing up and moving towards, as well as items that we should be taking action on. I think what this looks like is us building to a portfolio or a work plan of actions coupled with a schedule for implementation. By this really brief discussion today, I wanted to signal to you that, like many of you, I was impacted by that panel discussion. I thought it was fantastic. I thought it was unsatisfyingly short. I wanted more, which I thought was great. That's the way you want to leave them, one more. And I contemplate, and I'm interested in your feedback on having perhaps one of those individuals come and speak to us. I'd also like to have it at some point at this location so that I could ask staff into that discussion, or potentially I would ask them to do it twice, once here in a staff meeting and once at a remote board location if it didn't line up with San Luis Obispo. So that's what I'm thinking about climate change, and I encourage an offline discussion with you too about that.
Well, John, if I could add to that, you know, what I'd love to see as part of that kind of a discussion would be input on, you know, everything we could be doing as an agency to address.
From their perspective?
Yeah, other perspectives. I mean, staff knows what it's doing, but there may be some areas that maybe we haven't really thought about. Or are somewhat aware of, but really don't understand how we could be leveraging what we do, maybe, and collaborating in ways that, you know, just need to be presented to us. I think that would be kind of be interesting. And maybe it's someone from the governor has some office of, there is an office of climate change, I think, or something. Yeah,
so
like that.
One individual that I thought was super relevant was Jeff Mount. If you recall Jeff Mount from the panel, Jeff is a former professor of mine 1,000 years ago when I was at Davis. Jeff is unusually aware, by virtue of who he's married to, of the Water Board process and what the Water Board does. Barbara Evoy is his spouse, a retired State Board employee. And so if you recall from his presentation, he was talking about, and he jokingly said, my wife wants me to say, you know, and then he would fill in the blank about opportunity for board members to engage or to inquire about climate change levers to pull, so to speak. So he might be a particularly effective individual because he has insight into our organization too.
What about Barbara?
I think to your point. Yeah, I don't know that she is a climate change expert. Jeff may.
Right, but she understands the water
right,
boards.
Us, right. Okay, just putting that out there.
Okay.